Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session of today's call, you may press star one to ask a question. Today's call is being recorded, and at this time, I'll turn the call to Mr. J.D. Harrington. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, Shirley. Hello, I'm J.D. Harrington, Public Affairs Officer for NASA's Astrophysics Division in Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you to today's teleconference, where we will discuss findings of an extraordinary gamma ray burst that happened on April 27th of this year. This was a once-in-a-century watershed event made all the better by having a large array of NASA telescopes and ground-based observatories that's seen it. Before we begin, a few housekeeping details. We have four panelists joining us today. You can find graphics that the panelists will use by going to www.nasa.gov/Fermi and clicking on the link in the top right corner. Each panelist will give a 3 to 5 minute briefing, and once finished, we'll move to the question and answer session, accepting questions from media that dialed into the telephone bridge and those that submitted questions via Twitter using the hashtag AskNASA. Again, the graphics can be found by going to www.nasa.gov/Fermi, F-E-R-M-I. The graphics link is on the top right corner. This media telecon will be limited to 1 hour. Today's panelists include Paul Hertz, NASA's Astrophysics Division Director at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Charles Dermer, an astrophysicist at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. He's also the corresponding author of the Fermilat and GBM papers in the Science Journal. We have Thomas Vestren, an astrophysicist from the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico and lead author of the Raptor paper in today's Science Journal. And we have Krissa Kuvilotu, an astrophysicist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. She's the lead author of a New Star paper and AFJ letters, and co-author on the SWIFT paper and the Fermilat and GBM papers. And with that, we'll get started. Paul?
Thank you very much, J.D. So to set the stage, NASA's goals for astrophysics are quite simply to discover how the universe works, to explore how the universe began and developed into its present form, and to search for Earth-like planets. And to accomplish these goals, we operate space-based observatories such as the Hubble Space Telescope, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, and the Kepler Space Telescope, as well as smaller observatories from our Innovative Explorers program, including two of the observatories responsible for today's science result, SWIFT and New Star. And how do we ensure that we are developing and operating the space telescopes that can make the biggest science impact? Because we're committed to making sure that we spend the taxpayer money that's entrusted to us wisely. So when planning our future programs, we closely follow recommendations of the decadal surveys that are conducted by the National Academy of Sciences, and we receive advice regularly from the community through the NASA Advisory Council's Astrophysics Subcommittee. Then to implement our projects, such as the satellites that made today's discovery, Fermi, New Star, and SWIFT, we work closely with academic partners all over America, as well as with our international partners. Well, today, we're announcing findings on an extraordinary gamma ray burst that happened on April 27th of this year. This burst was a once-in-a-century cosmic event, and the studies reported today are possible only because the right NASA space telescopes and ground-based observatories were in place and prepared to make the necessary measurements. The April 27th burst, named GRB-130427A, and you can write that down, topped the charts in terms of duration, number of gamma-ray photons, energy of gamma-ray photons, total explosion energy, and radiance. It produced the second brightest optical flash ever detected from a gamma-ray burst, and you'll hear all the details from my colleagues here on the panel. The main point I'd like to get across is that we could not have made these discoveries without having in place multiple space observatories, each with a unique capability to study the universe in a different way and in a different energy band. No one telescope would have been adequate, and the collective data that we obtained enabled the findings that are going to be discussed today. With that, I'm turning it over to Chuck Dermer from the Naval Research Laboratory to start off the story about GRB 120427A. Chuck?
Thanks, Paul. So I'm Chuck Dermer from Naval Research Laboratory here in D.C., and today, as Paul mentioned, we're announcing the findings on this extraordinary gamma ray burst. It topped the charts in all sorts of categories: duration, length, number and energy of gamma ray photons, total explosion energy, the radiance. But first, let's give a little background about gamma rays. Those are photons of light, millions to billions of times the energy of the light photons that our eyes can see. Gamma ray bursts, as the name implies, are brief flashes of gamma rays originating from random directions in the sky. They're observed about once per day. After decades of study, we now know that a gamma ray burst is the radiation made during the birth of a black hole. The birthday of this particular black hole occurred last April 27th, so as Paul mentioned, we call it GRB 130427A, even though it actually occurred billions of years ago. April 27th was the day that the burst light first reached Earth. So you can see the first figure in the briefing material shows its birthday photo, made with a Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which has been in space now about 5 years. But it was unusual in many respects. It was relatively nearby, and being so nearby was 50 to 100 times brighter than any closer gamma ray burst yet detected. Its proximity allows us to test theories for gamma ray burst emissions. Being so close, we can get a good view of the galaxy where the burst took place and the emissions from the exploding stars that accompanied the gamma ray burst. Being so bright, it has illuminated cracks in our understanding of the gamma ray burst phenomenon. So let's look inside the fires of a gamma ray burst, and you'll see an artistic rendering in the first animation of the briefing, or you can just look at the still. But in the animation, if you start it, you see that the parent star of a gamma ray burst is thought to be one of very high mass, tens of solar masses, that is extremely luminous and drives off strong winds. Most gamma ray bursts occur when the core of a massive star runs out of nuclear fuel. Then it collapses under its own weight and forms a black hole. And we see in the animation a high mass star that has consumed its fuel collapse to a black hole and drives a jet of particles all the way through the collapsing star at nearly the speed of light. A powerful jet of particles and magnetic field breaks through the stellar surface. The underlying stellar explosion looks like a supernova, but with a big difference, namely the jet from the black hole and the black hole in the center. Amplification of the light by the fast-moving particles makes a bright gamma ray burst when an observer looks down the axis of the jet, and then it becomes extremely luminous. So this burst has many firsts. It's the brightest, longest, and highest energy GRB at high energy gamma rays. In terms of the energy passing through given surface area, it's the largest ever recorded. And this is the important quantity for calculating total energy release. We find that the energy released in all directions is essentially equal to the total mass of our sun, converted entirely to the energy of radiation within minutes to hours. Theorists have not been able to answer that puzzle except by invoking a black hole, and even that amount of energy seems too much for a black hole. So to make sense of gamma ray bursts, the system that seems to fit the data best is to have a black hole engine that powers two jets consisting of a gas consisting of particles and magnetic field, moving at nearly the speed of light. The beam geometry of the jet reduces the energy requirements, provided we are looking down the jet, as we think we must be. GRB 130427A emits gamma rays longer than any previous gamma ray burst, with multi-billion electron volt radiation. They were detected for nearly a day compared to 100 minutes for the earlier record setter. And these firsts were captured by the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. On top of that, Fermi found the highest energy gamma ray photon ever detected from a gamma ray burst, 95 billion electron volts, about 50 billion times the energy in a photon of light. Compared to most gamma ray bursts, whose light is stretched by a factor of 2 or more by the expansion of the universe, this burst was so close that its light is stretched by only about 34%. Now, if you go to the second animation, or the still, which has much the same information, you can see how we think the jet makes gamma rays. The main events that take place in the birth of a black hole are the thermal radiations of the hot gas formed in the black hole's birth. This is the engine emission. The jetted winds crashing into each other as the jet plows through the star and enters interstellar space. These are the internal shock waves. and the external shock waves made as the winds shock and sweep up the surroundings of the black hole nursery. This burst, 130427A, was so bright and well observed that our understanding is taking a beating. For example, it has late arriving high energy gamma rays that call into question our understanding of the high energy gamma ray emission and the entire burst mechanism. Why do some of the highest energy photons appear hours after the initial blast? This is hard to explain with our current models. Besides Fermi, GRB 130427A was observed promptly with the Raptor Rapid Response Optical Telescope with a swift mission at X-ray and gamma ray energies, and was for the first time detected days after the GRB at hard X-ray energies with a New Star telescope. The similar rise and fall of the optical and gamma rays was not expected because these radiations were thought to be made in separate regions. The decay of the hard X-ray flux and gamma ray flux in this burst has no clear breaks. We didn't expect them to fade so smoothly because we expected a change between emission mechanisms. So first we'll have Tom Vestrand of the Los Alamos National Lab tell us about the observations of this burst with Raptor, and Chris Acovelliotto of Marshall Space Flight Center will describe the new star first. Tom?
Yes, thank you, Chuck. I'm Tom Vestrand at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we saw with ground-based telescopes.
Ready.
So on the evening of the 27th of April, three Raptor full-sky monitoring telescopes in New Mexico and Hawaii detected a bright celestial flash from the constellation of Leo. Now, this flash reached a brightness of about 7th magnitude and lasted for 80 seconds before it faded below the sensitivity limit of those all-sky cameras. Now, optical flashes associated with gamma ray bursts that are this bright are extremely rare. This is only the second one we've seen as bright as this, and it's the first to allow detailed comparison of the optical light curve with the gamma ray variations that are measured all the way up to the extremely high energies by the Fermi LAT. Now, independently, as this flash was fading from our all-sky camera images, our much more sensitive robotic Raptor-T multicolor telescope received notification of a gamma ray burst localization by the Fermi and Swift, and we rapidly slewed to begin color imaging of the fading GRB optical afterglow. It turned out that this GRB optical afterglow was exactly the same source that generated the bright optical flash that I mentioned in the full sky monitors. Now, I'd like to show you, have a look at Raptor-T, if you look at the image there, and it's the world's fastest slewing telescope for making color images of gamma ray afterglows. And the way it works is we have four core-line synchronized telescope tubes with different filters. We're using black and white cameras to get the precision we need, but we use these filters in front. And it's very much an analogy to the way Hollywood did the Technicolor process in the old days before they had good color film stocks. And, for example, that was used on movies like The Wizard of Oz. So in the spirit of Wizard of Oz, I'd like to show you the Raptor movie. And if you open that up now, you'll see that it starts out in black and white. That's from the all-sky monitors. And then it zooms in to color imaging that's done with our Raptor-T Technicolor telescope. And what you see is, as it zooms in, you see the counterpart, the optical counterpart to the gamma ray burst. It has a blue color. It's right in the center of the image there. And for the next 2 hours, it's slowly fading away with this blue color. Now, the relationship between the variations of the visible light and the intensity and variations of the gamma rays is a very important diagnostic for understanding how the visible light is generated. And the taxonomy of optical emission from gamma ray bursts breaks down into two broad classes. One is called prompt optical emission, whose brightness variations are closely linked to the variations in the low-energy gamma ray emission. This link is one that's generated because they're both, we believe, generated by a variable explosion engine. The second type of optical light we see is an optical afterglow emission where the variations in the optical light are completely unrelated to the low-energy gamma ray brightness variations. Now, this optical light usually persists much longer than the lower-energy gamma ray emission, and we believe it's generated as the ejecta from the explosion impacts the surrounding environment. So what did we find for this burst? And if you look at the plot of the multi-wavelength light curves, the first comparison we did was with these lower energy gamma rays that were measured by Swift in the Fermi GBM, and it looks like just like what we would expect for bright optical afterglow emission. But the interesting thing is when we did a comparison with the Fermi LAT, and we found a stunning result, that this optical afterglow emission seems to be closely correlated with what we saw at the very highest energies in the Fermi LAT. And this solves a puzzle that had been standing associated with how these very highest energy gamma rays persisted much longer than the lower energy gamma rays. We now have the answer that those very highest energy gamma rays must be generated as the burst ejecta collides with the external medium around the object and a shockwave is generated that accelerates particles to the very highest energies. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Krissa, who will tell you a bit about the later time observations of that interaction of the shock with the surrounding medium.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I am Krissa Kuvilioto at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, and I will talk to you about the results that we obtained with NUSTER. NUSTER, as Paul mentioned, is a small explorer mission which was launched in June 2012, and the space mission is unique in that it has two telescopes which utilize a new generation of hard X-ray optics and detectors that focus X-rays in an area which has not been adequately focused before, adequately observed before, between 3,000 and 79,000 electron volts. So basically what NUSTER brings to the table is a very, very high sensitivity in this region and very low background. But the primary mission of NUSTER is not on gamma ray burst science, so in that sense, this mission is a new kid in the block in gamma ray bursts. In order to observe a gamma ray burst, we had to submit a proposal that basically had a custom-made gamma ray burst, which would effectively be the burst of the century. And what we wanted was a burst that we actually knew exactly the location that it was coming from, the direction of the sky. We knew the distance of the burst so that we could do the energetics. It had to be a very bright event so that LAT could repoint and observe and collect high energy data. It would have to be associated with a supernova, and it would have to be observed with a multi-wavelength observatory so that we can describe the emission in many, many wavelengths. So as you can see, this was an ordered, custom-made event, and it was a very rare event. It would have indeed to be the event of the century within the two-year primary mission phase of NUSTER. So we kind of assigned it to the miracle drawer because we didn't expect to catch it during these 2 years, and we did. And we are delighted we did. So why are the NUSTER observations important? Because this is another first. They do cover a wavelength range, or an energy range, if you wish, that has not been covered in the past for any afterglow observations. And, of course, since we were looking at this range for the first time, and since we knew about these very unique, very high-energy photons that happened in the past, that were observed with the LAT, we were thinking we would find a different component, a new component that would be responsible for these photons. We were very well poised to identify and measure such a component, and we were expecting to find it. So we collected two types of things. One is light curves, which basically tells us the rate of light arrival for different wavelengths, and also spectra, which describe the energy distribution of this light. If you look at the graphic, which shows the actual light curves, as Tom mentioned earlier, you can see that, for instance, if you look at the right bottom corner of this plot, that the NUSTER data, which are the yellow and red and orange colors, they actually follow the same trend of decay with practically everything that has been observed at the same time. which tells us that there is no extra component. On the other hand, when we looked at the distribution of energies in this energy range, which was not observed before, we actually see that they confirm only a single component. We do not identify a different component there. So basically, the data across a very broad spectral band agree that there was even the LAT photons part of the same single emission mechanism, which we attribute to synchrotron emission, which synchrotron emission is a type of non-thermal radiation which is generated by electrons spiraling around magnetic field lines very fast, close to the speed of light. So, great for the photons. We know they come from the same team, but it's puzzling from the scientists because these photons violate by far the theoretically assigned limits, which is called the maximum synchrotron energy, which postulates that the electron acceleration, actually we do know that the electron acceleration in the magnetic field is limited by the radiation losses. As it gyrates, it accelerates, it gains energy, but it loses energy as well. And the limit that we're talking about introduces a maximum energy that any of these photons can reach, which is independent of the magnetic field. This was violated. Why do we care? Because the assumptions that were used in modeling this energy must give. Something must break. Why do we care about that? Because right now we have found that a fundamental physical process and our understanding of it has been challenged. In other words, we have to go back to the drawing board and understand the physics of blast waves moving close to the speed of light and how they accelerate particles to very high energies and generate magnetic fields. So all these assumptions used in modeling must have and do have a lot of tooth fairies. And one thing at this point is certain. A lot of theorists will have to work hard and go beyond our current understanding to accommodate this result. And Chuck Dermer will now summarize the importance of this burst for you.
Thank you, Krista. So we're talking about five discovery papers that are being published in scientific journals, and we can only briefly talk about three today, but let me just mention the importance. Because of these different satellites and observatories, they're painting that view at different wavelengths of light. They're helping to paint a new picture of the burst system. And so we can now test our models for the gamma ray burst engine, for the internal shocks in the jet, and the afterglow radiations formed by the external shock wave. So as we heard from Tom, the Raptor and Fermi-LAT observations give the first detailed look at how optical light and very high-energy gamma rays are related in these powerful explosions. The Raptor flash optical data closely tracks Fermi-LAT GEV emissions, contrary to what we expected, meaning that the prompt optical data, that the early optical data, is related to the external shockwave, not the internal shockwaves, as we thought. For new stars, Krista described, the observations challenged the synchrotron model, suggesting non-standard shock physics, a prediction from a dozen years ago of spectral changes from one emission component to another, is not borne out by the data, nor is a 30-year-old prediction about the nature of the highest energy photons. So some of our theories are just going down the drain, and they have to be reconfigured. But a paper we didn't talk about today is the Fermi GBM. This is the gamma ray burst monitor on Fermi that is dedicated to looking at gamma ray bursts. And this paper only concentrated on the triggering pulse, the very early first pulse, but because the burst was so bright, we have spectacular data of this evolving spectrum at different wavelengths. And this spectral choreography has confounded all the pulse models based on colliding shells, which has been the most widely accepted model. So we're seeing a paradigm shift. If you go back to the figure, instead of the emissions from the colliding shells, it seems like the emissions from the central black hole are more important. On top of that, the SWIFT satellite highlights burst evolution from the prompt to the afterglow phase, revealing properties similar to the typical high redshift gamma ray bursts. This suggests that GRBs in the contemporary universe and in the early distant universe share a common central engine. Nevertheless, modeling in the different papers haven't converged on the relative relative importance of shockwave structure or the type of surrounding medium. Taken together, GRB-130427A has opened a new chapter in gamma ray burst studies by providing the most detailed multi-wavelength data from which to test theories. This is a tribute to the good planning on NASA's part and the coordination among different observatories on Earth and in space. And with that, I'll hand it back to JD.
Thanks, Charlie. And with that, we'll start the question and answer session. We have several reporters on the telephone bridge today. As such, we'll need to limit everyone to one question and one follow-up. Once everyone has a chance to ask their question, and if time permits, we'll start from the beginning again. Shirley, our operator, should identify you, but if she can't, I ask that you identify yourself, your media affiliation, and then direct your question to a specific panelist, if possible, to eliminate any confusion. And for those dialing in, push the star 1 keys on your telephone to be placed in the queue. To use Twitter, send your questions to hashtag AskNASA. And with that, we'll begin. Shirley?
Thank you. And again, just press star 1 to ask a question. And our first question comes from Seth Bornstein with Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you. It's Seth Bornstein at AP. I guess this is for any of you, but maybe Dr. Dermer. When you think of GRBs, obviously, if you're close to them and in the wrong direction, in the focused path of the beam, that's not good. And I guess what I'm wondering about, since this is such a potent burst and so close, relatively speaking, still 3.8 billion light years, let me give you the two questions instead of a follow. One is, how close would you have to be for a GRB this size aimed at Earth to essentially end life here like GRBs would? In other words, this is 3.8 billion light years and we're safe. At what point would we not be safe if it were aimed in our direction? And secondly, along the same lines, how often do you expect to see GRBs of sort of this size in the Milky Way?
Thanks. Both of those are great questions and closely related. In fact, if a gamma ray burst like this went off in the Milky Way, it could do severe damage, and calculations, some of which I've been part of, have considered whether extinction events, and there's this Ordovician extinction that has been attributed by Professor Adrian Malott at University of Kansas to a gamma ray burst in our galaxy. But that happened some 200-300 million years ago, and that pretty much gives you the time scale for when we think gamma ray bursts like this might occur in our galaxy and have a harmful effect. So the chance of anything happening tomorrow and being dangerous is virtually nil. And in fact, if you consider GRB-130427A, in spite of its power, it was seventh magnitude in optical, as Tom described, and it was 100 trillion times farther away from the sun. So it wasn't an impressive-looking event until you realize just how distant it is. So
that's perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ian Thompson with the Register. You may ask your question.
Thank you. A couple of things. The main question I just wanted to get cleared up. If I'm understanding this correctly, the theory was that the most energetic gamma rays would be produced by the formation of the black hole itself. And what this data is showing is that, in fact, the blast wave from the collapsing star interacting with other objects within the vicinity is what's causing these later higher energy gamma bursts. I just wanted to check if that was correct.
Not quite right. So there are two energy scales in the gamma rays that we're most concerned.
Data collected from the burst correspond or illuminate a better understanding of the CMB data.
Okay. Sorry, I got sidetracked. But anyway, there's million electron volt photons.
Mm-hmm.
That's thought to be either from the colliding shells of the wind and from the central engine. But it's hard to accelerate electrons to high energies to make high energy GEV, billion electron volt radiation. And that's supposed to be due to the external shock. So we anticipated the highest energy radiation would be through the external shock, but we didn't anticipate it to be at such high energies at such late times. This was a complete surprise. And the other surprise is we thought, and people still think, that it's the colliding shells in the jet that make most of this MEV, million electron volt emission. But the paradigm shift that's taking place is now that it's really the engine emissions, the hot plasma in the vicinity of this black hole engine that's making most of the million electron volt radiations.
Got it. Okay. And then just coming back to the question from at AP, I mean, the gamma rays have reached us, but I mean, in terms of any effects on Earth, we wouldn't have seen any kind of, there wouldn't be any electronic distortion or beyond that picked up by the telescopes.
Also a really good question. Indeed, gamma ray bursts have affected the Earth in the past, but only weakly. They cause an ionospheric disturbance. They ring the magnetosphere of the Earth and cause some disruptions of communications. But for this type of gamma ray burst, where it makes most of its energy at really high energies, it doesn't really affect the magnetosphere as much as a subclass of bursts that have lower energy radiations. And they can do much more, have a bigger effect. But in terms of communications, there's a very small chance that this could have an impact. But anything else, only on geological timescales.
Marvelous. Thank you very much.
I'd like to add on this. I'd like to add that really what has affected the ionosphere of the Earth is the eruptions of the so-called giant flares from soft gamma ray emitters, which basically are galactic objects. They are within our galaxy. They are not as dangerous as gamma ray bursts, but they have affected and been observed in the distortions of the ionosphere as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, if you have a question, just press star 1. Our next question comes from Denise Chow with space.com. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I think this is for Dr. Dermer. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on the implications of having to rethink some of these models that are you currently use. Are there other principles or theories in physics that might be affected that we might have to revisit as a result?
That's a pretty hard question to answer. This paradigm shift to going from the colliding shells, which I've spent a lot of time working out the physics of, so basically you have one shell, which is moving nearly the speed of light, slam into another shell that's also moving nearly the speed of light, but not quite as fast, and then it lights up, accelerates particles. That's not an easy system to work out, but over the last 10 or 15 years, lots of people have worked on it. But now the direction is toward the very hottest emissions at the center of the black hole. So if the shell collisions were hard, this is much more difficult. This is like early universe, in terms of its temperatures, it's millions of degrees, and it has electrons, positrons, gamma rays, other particles, and there are all sorts of processes. So the question now is, if this colliding shell wind model, or the shells making emissions, isn't working, can we make this other region near the black hole? As you know, once you get the closer you get to the black hole, the harder the physics gets. So that's all in progress now. Lots of people are starting to work on it, but it's a very difficult problem.
And if I could just ask a follow-up, are there estimates on how large the black hole is?
Okay, these are all the gamma ray bursts here are sort of the outcome of the evolution of a high-mass star, 30 to 100 solar masses, and their core is up 1 to 10 solar masses. So the black hole that's formed is on the order of 1 to 10 solar masses. We don't have an idea any more precise than that, but they're not supermassive black holes. We know they have to be very small black holes, small in the sense of not being a billion solar masses. Because if they were large, you can't have this rapid variability so easily. And gamma ray bursts vary so quickly, and they emit so much energy and power that only a black hole seems to fit the bill.
Thanks.
Again, press star 1 to ask a question. Again, if you have a question, just press star 1 at this time.
I'm sorry, we pushed another mute mic here that muted them all. I do have a question here from Twitter. As a reminder, though, if you have questions, you can push the star 1 key on your cell phone or submit your questions via the hashtag AskTwitter. Ask NASA, I'm sorry. The question is, does the data collected from the BLAST correspond or illuminate a better understanding of the CMB data? Probably go to you, Chuck.
Well, I could answer that in a number of different ways. For the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the early universe, the leftover remnant, to the extent that it's related to a gamma ray burst, I kind of alluded to the fact that when you're looking at these optically thick, very energetic emissions, there's some relationship between the early universe and the gamma ray burst. But just to be more direct and correct, although the CMB relates to black hole physics in enormous ways, the most relevant way that black holes from gamma ray bursts relate to both the cosmic microwave background and the light formed from stars and other black holes throughout the universe is that these gamma rays have to come to us through this fog of photons that are made by stars and black holes and this cosmic microwave background. Now, once you get above a certain energy, depending on the distance, the fog is too thick. You don't see them. And we see energies up to about 100 GeV from this burst. But if we were trying to see photons about 10 times more energetic, they would be absorbed by the intervening fog of photons from dust, gas, stars, black holes that have been made, and even CMB if you get to sufficiently high energies. So we can use that absorption to actually infer the amount of radiation that they pass through. But the direct use of gamma ray bursts to study CMB is, I would say, not so. It's not direct. It's indirect in the fashion I just described. So.
Now, are you ready for a question on the phone lines?
You can go, Shirley.
Thank you. And the question comes from Seth Bornstein with Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you. That's just to follow up on what you said earlier to my last question. When you talk about the Ordovician extinction event of about 450 million years ago, now that was about 6,000 light years away, according to what I've seen. Would it be fair to say that it was likely a smaller GRB than the one we've seen here, but because it's closer? And I guess, would this one, the one some people like Rob Priest are calling the monster, would this one just have to be in the Milky Way to be an extinction event, or would it have to be near? So I just want to clarify that.
You're building improbability on top of improbability. So by the time you get to the end of it, it's not very likely. Indeed, you'd have to be looking. The beam would have to be pointed toward us.
Right.
And already, if the opening angle of the beam is only one part in 100 of the full sky, that means you would need 100 other gamma ray bursts that would likely be missing the Earth. But no, as long as it's in the Milky Way, it could do substantial damage. But it would have to be of this long duration, which this object is a long duration type burst.
Yeah.
But it's unusual because it's close. That's why it's bright. It's not an unusual burst, and this is what the Swift paper showed very clearly. It seems to be typical of the bursts that happen at characteristic distances much farther away, but we can't see the details because they're so dim. So this gives us confidence that when we study this particular burst, we're getting good information about the bursts that we have much poorer information about. But they do release roughly the same energies, or they can, and have the same luminosities. It's just that this guy is so much closer.
What about the one that's been theorized with the
Well, okay, so no, there hasn't been any specific event, just the possibility. And
Okay.
And since I sort of have an inside track on that, one of the reasons I'm more skeptical about that possibility is that it's been shown that gamma ray bursts are probably related to low metallicity galaxies. This is kind of a technical aside, but it's important. So when you, our galaxy makes lots of stars, and those stars explode, and they put metals into the environment, and they make new stars. And when you get those type of stars, they're not so effective in making gamma ray bursts. So we think a different type of galaxy that has lower metallicity is more favorable for making gamma ray bursts. So this doesn't help the hypothesis. I'm not saying it rules it out. It just doesn't support it. So it's more difficult to sustain it as a result of the fact that we don't see gamma ray burst host galaxies that look like our galaxy. I mean, to first order.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push star star button on your phone, star one on your phone, and we'll get back to you. We'll wait 10, 15 seconds. If none, we'll close this out.
And at this time, I'm showing no further questions.
All right. Appreciate it, Shirley. I guess that'll do it then for our news telecon. I'd like to thank our panelists and our operator, Shirley, for their time today. As a reminder, we will hold a Google Plus Hangout tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on the same subject to answer any other questions that come up about this GRB. And finally, for more information about the findings of this gamma ray burst or any of NASA's other programs and projects, visit us on the web at www.nasa.gov or via any of our many social media venues such as Facebook, Google Plus, Twitter, and YouTube. Once again, thanks for joining us and have a great day.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.